This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
Today's podcast episode is a GHIL lecture by Stefan Hans, Senior Lecturer in Early Modern History at the University of Manchester, on the scientific analysis of Renaissance recipes, medicine and the body in German material Renaissance. The quote, material Renaissance, unquote, historians have argued was an age of experimentation, and recipes were at the heart of this cultural movement. New collaborations between the humanities and the sciences allow for novel insights into Renaissance recipe cultures, and more specifically the degree of material experimentation and engagement by, quote, recipe practitioners, unquote. Scientific analysis and thorough historical contextualization of the chemical fingerprints of recipe users offer a new understanding of material cultures, medicine, and the history of the body in early modern Germany. Which ingredients were used? How were they used and what for? Which substances were altered and why? And what can be said about their impact on the human body? This lecture focuses on early modern Augsburg and discusses topics as wide-ranging as hair care and toothache. It contributes to research on recipes as well as to the new history of material practices, early modern medicine, and material and medical practitioners in early modern Germany.
Thank you very, very much for this invitation. A very warm welcome, the fantastic support in organizing this event. My thanks go to Michael Scheich, to Ole Münch, Pascal Siegrist, Kim König, and everybody who was involved behind the scene in organizing this event. It is really a huge privilege, a huge joy for me to be here today. As you heard, it's a very special event for me, since the GHIL holds a very special place in my biography. In retrospection, this was the place that introduced me to UK academia. And I say this in order to stress the significance of the work that is done in the German historical institutes and the German cultural institutes abroad. Such institutes, the people and the funding that goes into them really make a difference in terms of knowledge production, knowledge exchange, and people's lives. So it is very special for me to be here and to talk about a truly collaborative project. And it is really thanks to the amazing work of its members that I can present such research today. So this is also an opportunity for me to thank Gleb Silberstein, Sam Presley, Julianne Simpson, Tony Richards, Svetlana Silberstein, Pier Giorgio Righetti, and Elizabeth Carr, who were all involved in this research, for their commitment and enthusiasm. And I also wish to thank the John Rylands Research Institute and Library, as well as the Leverhulme Trust, who have generously funded this project. And what I'm talking about today is actually both the end and the beginning of a project, if I can put it that way. So what I present today is based on an article that is submitted and currently under review. And it is also part of a big external grant application on the scientific analysis of Renaissance recipes. So altogether, fantastic opportunity to get feedback, and I'm very grateful for that. The material Renaissance, historians have argued, was an age of experimentation. Contemporary spearheaded material innovation, appreciated the intricacy of making, furnished complex knowledge about the properties and behaviors of materials, cherished sophisticated artisanal skills, and material cultures shaped ever denser global circuits. Bodily and tacit knowledge of nature shaped the spiral and engagement with materials like feathers, shells, or plants, and was crucial to the significance of the period's key concepts like ingenuity, taste, or refinement. People also conducted quotidian home-based investigations of the natural world, or household science, as Elaine Leong calls it. Households, gardens, kitchens, and farms turned into extremely important sites for observing, inquiring, and testing the workings of materials via recipe trials, further fostering engagement with the vibrant world of matter. Pamela Smith's research has shown that Renaissance how-to instructions became crucial to the founding and growth of a new philosophy that proclaimed a hands-on approach to the study of nature. Recipes are at the very heart of this cultural movement, evidencing the extent to which 16th century women and men invested into acquiring, testing and experimenting with recipes to construct bodily, material, and medical knowledge. Early modern Europeans, as Leon has aptly put it, were gripped by recipe fever. And also in 16th century Germany, Alicia Rankin's field-shaping research has shown the compilation, collection, and exchange of medicinal remedies saw a sudden popularity. Recipes were even called an art, Kunst, and households were thus imbued with wider epistemologies of making and recipes, a prime site of a vernacular science of matter. Recipes document the extent to which practitioners creatively engaged with the vibrant material world, and yet such texts are first and foremost characterized by a profound lack of contextual information. The textual record is often silent about people's experimentation with recipes, their alterations and amendments of ingredients and instructions, and the wider motivations and consequences of such decisions. And researchers have therefore a particular interest in recovering what is not written down in recipes. To get a fuller picture of the complex relationship between instructions and material know-how, at a time in which the circulation and knowledge of materials dynamized, and in which creativity in making and material engagement were held in extremely high esteem. Collaborations between the humanities and sciences, I argue, allow for novel insights into the material world of Renaissance recipe collections and cultures, in particular the experimentation and engagement cultivated by practitioners. Recipes called for action, and early modern users left behind invisible chemical traces on the surface of the paper that have thus far not been studied. The scientific analysis and thorough historical contextualization of the biochemical fingerprints of early modern recipe users, I argue, reveal an exciting new range of insights into the age of material experimentation. Which ingredients were used? How? What for? Which substances were altered? What can be said about the impact on human bodies? These are just some of the questions that can be addressed in novel ways, with a focus on the advanced scientific analysis of proteins, amino acid chains, the basic chemical and material elements of human life, but early modern users left behind on the surface of the paper. This approach allows for new forms of contextualization and historicization, and thus shifts, to adapt Leora Auslander's powerful wording, the very nature of the questions we are able to pose and the kind of knowledge we are able to acquire by the past. This study is therefore a contribution to interdisciplinary research on recipes, as well as to the new history of material practices, early modern medicine, and Renaissance material and medical practitioners. This paper develops an inclusive, collaborative and interdisciplinary method. As a team of scientific archaeologists, chemists, conservators, curators, historians, lab technicians, photographers, and material scientists, we have combined advanced imaging technologies and proteomics as non-invasive interpretative tools to study how to cure and expel all afflictions and illnesses of the human body, and a useful and essential little book of medicine for the common man. Two hands-on manuals of medicinal recipes published by Bartholomäus Vogter in Augsburg in 1531, bound together into one volume held in the John Rylance Research Institute and Library, Manchester. And this book is covered with 16th and 17th century German marginalia that allow for a broader social and cultural contextualization that is indispensable for the thorough reading of scientific data. Such marginalia, moreover, point to early modern readers' intense material engagement with these recipes and hence to the availability of rich chemical information. And this object-based analysis is paired with archival research and the study of further sources, namely medical and botanical treatises, herbals, and records of Augsburg medical practitioners, such as the Guild of the Barbers and the Guild of the Barber Surgeons. And what follows, I will first situate Vogter's recipes in the wider social historical context. So I'm going to talk a bit more about Renaissance Augsburg first. And then I'm going to discuss the scientific method, analysis, and findings in more depth. Vogter's Afflictions and Little Book of Medicine are exemplary for the vast number of vernacular medical manuals printed in the first decades of the 16th century, providing the common man with a rich collection of recipes of everyday use. Following tradition, Vogter structures recipes according to the location of the symptoms from head to toe, remedies against brain diseases, nephrolysis, infertility, and other severe illnesses are discussed alongside more quotidian recipes, such as the treatment of contaminated wounds, eczema, hair loss, and instructions, for instance, on how to dye one's hair and how to restore hair growth. Fructose recipes also fed into the increasing popularity of distillation manuals that spread expertise and experimentation with medical distillation across 16th century German households. The prominent woodcut on Fructose title page, depicting a woman and man distilling plants with curative powers, caters towards such interests and invites readers to engage hands-on with printed recipe instructions. So Fructose recipes are firmly anchored in a book market flooded with recipes, Arzneibücher, Probierbüchlein, Kunstbüchlein, that point, in Alinka Rublak's words, to widely distributed practices of making, which were available to craft specialists as well as laypersons during this period, and addressed renewed concerns about how to foster well-being. Fructose recipes, in fact, had a profound impact on the exploding market of printed recipes. So it was first published in Augsburg by Heinrich Steiner in 1531, and Fructose recipes were to become what we would call today a bestseller. They catapulted Steiner's printing business into new spheres of success. He was to become the largest printing shop in Augsburg in the 1530s, and they were reprinted plenty of times. Even the woodcut of the title page was adapted in contemporary herbals. So Fructose recipes were iconic, best-selling go-to manuals for Renaissance domestic medicinal making. And the success of Fructose recipes is linked to the bustling entrepreneurial climate of Renaissance Augsburg. In this imperial city of circa 30,000 inhabitants, experimentation was everywhere. Merchants propelled trade across Europe and the world, and guilds spearheaded refined artistic and artisanal production that was marketed across Europe by industrious art dealers. Jörg Breu, Hans Burgmeier, and Hans Schäufelein ranked among the most innovative artists of the time, who also produced woodcuts for the booming print market and for Steiner's printing business in particular. Steiner also mingled with the most powerful circles of the town and hired the private teacher of the banker family of the Fuggers for the translation of humanist prints. So it is this city's mercantile, artisanal, and financial climate of remarkable entrepreneurship and its role as a hub of print patronage and material cultures that also shaped the afflictions and the little book of medicine. Bartholomäus Vogta was an eye doctor from Dillingen, a town near Augsburg, serving the Augsburg Prince Bishop, Christoph von Stadion. The nobleman theologian had just started office in 1517 when the Reformation divided Augsburg into a largely Catholic ruling class and towns and craftspeople of predominantly Lutheran faith. An harsh opponent of the Reformation first, Stadion developed a more moderate stance resulting from his friendship with Erasmus of Rotterdam. And the publication of the recipe collection of Stadion's personal physician, Bartholomäus Vogta, for the benefits of the common man, as it is said on the title, only 1 year after the Augsburg Imperial Diet and the Confessio Augustana that secured the city's biconfessional status, can thus be understood as the prince bishop's gesture towards the well-being, healing, and prosperity of the city and its residents. And in fact, over generations, we know the Vogtas had systematically gathered recipes, they had systematically engaged and strategically engaged in the staggering opportunities resulting from dynamic cultures of print and patronage. So Bartholomäus' father, his brothers, his nephew were leading physicians, eye doctors, and craftsmen, and they published recipe collections themselves. The demand for Fructose recipes also resulted from the vibrant medical marketplace of Renaissance Augsburg. This was a diverse healing community shaped by civic healthcare institutions like hospitals, poorhouses, bathhouses, by women's rich healing expertise, by barber surgeons, barbers, grocers trading with medicine, spices, and drugs, as well as specialized apothecaries and learned physicians. So early modern Augsburg was characterized by overlapping diverse and dynamic healing communities, and patients made use of a wide range of medical expertise, and domestic remedies like those of Vogta continued to be held in high esteem. Lay knowledge also circulated widely in this printing hub. The first German medical regiment, in fact, was printed in Augsburg in 1475, and Augsburg Incunabula, like Herbarius zu Teutsch, 1496, rated among the most detailed medical herbals of the time. So folk test recipes really testify to the dynamic career opportunities associated with the creation of new hands-on medical and material knowledge in Renaissance Augsburg. The Rylands copy of folk test prints is covered with early modern handwritten comments that evidence a vivid climate of medicinal experimentation. So this volume was used. It was used a lot by 16th and 17th century reader practitioners. The term reader practitioner leans on the terminology of author practitioners developed by the Making and Knowing team to highlight the overlapping artisanal and scholarly nature of early modern recipe writing, as well as these artisan authors focus on the embodied nature of knowledge making. So folk test readers, practitioners shared similar interests. On painful days, reads one comment next to remedies against urolifts. Another remark explains parsley, powdered or soaked in wine, best medicine. Throughout the volume, noteworthy recipes and ingredients are highlighted. A lengthy list of antipyretic remedies encouraged a reader practitioner to mark the use of golden shower, the anal administration of the juice of broadleaf plantain, and the leaves of scarlet hawthorn, eaten over 9 days, with the number of leaves consumed per day corresponding to the number of days of the treatment as, quote, the best remedy. These marginalia are paper strategies to maneuver material practices and material knowledge. They highlight individual remedies, record their efficacy, comment on ingredients, and added recipes to treat diarrhea, headaches, stomach aches, toothaches, and urolifts. With their focus on experience and making, marginalia helped create a community of practitioners and fostered, in Rankin's words, an inclination toward empirical and experiential knowledge as a way of evaluating medical efficacy. And marginalia also provide rare clues about the reader practitioner's identity. An added handwritten recipe is dated 1533, at least 2 years after their publication, thus folk test recipes were in use. Another added recipe points to the volume's links to various family members. For the stone sister, take slow, dried and powdered. Eat from this in the morning on an empty stomach and in the evening prior to the night, 3 full knife points respectively. Written in different 16th and 17th century hands, such notes corroborate the volume's multiple ownership. A note inside the cover explains how the copy came into the possession of the Oettels. On December the 22nd, 1624, I, Miss Anna Wolf Jakob Gralantin, sent this old book to my dear 4 years long amiable wet nurse, Madalena Christoph Oettlin, born in Stra, there's a damage on the page, unfortunately, maybe Strasbourg, I don't know, against the age. Recipe collections were considered a treasure, a schatz of knowledge, and handed down over generations within the family. And also folk test recipes were passed on from parents to children, among siblings and to wet nurses. The exchange of recipes materialized a culture of care and turned recipes into a means of community making. So used and handed down for almost 100 years, it was an act of caring. When Anna gifted folk test trusted recipes to her wet nurse on the 4th of Advent in 1624. And we know that Madalena by that time was of old age. Maybe she was struggling with the same, with some of the afflictions and illnesses that Fuchter promised to cure. Since wet nursing was considered to establish embodied kinship, this was a gift to an inside member of the effective circle of household healthcare. So such marginalia allow for rare glimpses into the social, material, and emotional world of folk test reader practitioners, highlighting the key role of women in domestic cultures of medicinal making and in shaping the effective bonds of household science. Whenever the Gralantins, Oettels, and other early modern reader practitioners put their hand down on paper to comment on folk test recipes, they left invisible biochemical information on the paper surface that we sampled and analyzed. The print itself contains plenty of user marks and signs, yet advanced imaging technologies allow for more information to contextualize sampling and analysis. The Rylands world-leading imaging laboratory run non-invasive multispectral imaging analysis using lighting conditions that combine ultraviolet and infrared wavelengths with filters to capture fluorescence. So such wavelengths are beyond the visible human light range and recover invisible information. Basically, you can take pictures of the invisible. Multispectral imaging made illegible marginalia accessible for interpretation, recovering, for instance, a reader practitioner's instructions for the use of viola and scorpion oil against urolists and ulcers, respectively. Infrared and ultraviolet frequencies also captured material traces of historical use, not visible to the human eye. Moreover, a stain's response to different wavelengths revealed its internal layering. Thus, while imaging and chemical analysis do not allow for the identification of historical fingerprints with individual users, wavelength-specific responses help differentiate between different instances of use, and such information is crucial for improving the historical contextualization of proteomics results and empowers researchers to make informed sampling decisions. We applied two sampling methods for proteomics analysis. 15 ethylene vinyl acetate plastic film diskettes. In future, I'm going to speak about EVA, this abbreviation. Started with cation anion exchangers and hydrophobic resins to capture proteomics via ion-ion interaction, have been positioned on the print's margins, nearby early modern marginalia, exactly where the hand of the writing reader practitioner would have been located. Gleb Silberstein's spring-style tech design team produced these films in conversation with conservators, curators, and historians in Manchester. York archaeologist Sam Presley took the samples that were then analyzed in York and Oxford laboratories using liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometry. So basically, this procedure ionizes, thus charges the sampled molecules by using a beam of electrons. And once charged, molecules mass charge ratio can be detected, which allows for the identification of individual amino acid chains. We also used eraser sampling to frame these EVA results. So basically, you use a PVC eraser that generates an electrostatic charge on the surface of the paper, which allows you to sample already loosened collagen fibers. Analyzed in the lab, these samples confirmed the more detailed EVA results on the same pages. And I should stress that this is really a very recent development. EVA is a very recent development in the still very young field of proteomics. I think it's a revolutionary advancement of sampling that allows for the non-invasive study of cultural heritage. And this paper presents really the first interdisciplinary discussion of EVA methodology for the study of Renaissance recipes and health. The biggest challenge, let's speak a bit about the limitations and challenges of this. The biggest challenge of EVA is the differentiation between primary and secondary microscopic records, thus proteins of early modern and more recent uses. Established protocols avoid contamination. However, scientific analysis still cannot date sampled proteins. And we hope to further advance this methodology with a focus on dating in a future large-scale project on the proteomics analysis of Renaissance recipes. For now, strategic sampling and interdisciplinary contextualization, as outlined above, is the only way forward. However, there are important clues regarding the historicity of sampled information. We can infer modern from old by the number and type of modification on peptides. So deamidation and oxidation are indicators of degradation, and the more of these modifications can be seen, the more likely it is that they are of older age. Quantity is indicative too. So the exorbitant number of findings on one particular sample, more than 2,000 peptides, led to an exclusion of this as a contaminated sample. In contrast, the stable number of circa 50 to 200 peptides in all other samples speaks for their historicity. And two further clues are indicative. So first, all but one EVA sample contained albumin, hemoglobin, and hemopexin, elements of human blood. So this is a bloodshed. This book is a bloodshed. Such findings result from the past handling of the book, since a much fuller protein record would be expected if the blood traces to modern users. And second, something else indicative, the omnipresence of cow proteins is noteworthy. On the one hand, this points to the use of cow-related ingredients. So cow proteins, for instance, were sampled next to a recipe of marinating ox tongue in wine to increase brain power. On the other hand, cow proteins point to the use of animal glue in early modern cotton paper. So findings of cow proteins across samples thus indicate the early modern historicity of the sampled biochemical information, as does the absence of mold and younger chemicals like those used by 19th and 20th century curators and conservators. Moreover, keratin, a prominent element of hair, was found in all samples next to hair care recipes. And I'm particularly interested in hairs, you know. So from the very outset of the beginning, conversations between conservators, curators, researchers, and scientists provided contextualization that served the preparation of sampling and analysis to ensure authenticity. Altogether, we sequenced 111 proteins alongside hundreds of information regarding individual amino acid chains. Thoroughly contextualized, such data provide unique insights in Renaissance medicine, namely the nature of experimentation with recipes, the global circulation of ingredients and illnesses, as well as the bodily impact of remedies. And that's what I'm going to talk about for the remaining 20 minutes or so. Proteomics confirmed the use of some of the ingredients. So peptide traces of European beech, watercress, and rosemary were recovered next to recipes recommending the use of these plants to cure hair loss and to strengthen the growth of facial and head hair. Recipes on nearby pages also considered beech a powerful soporific and cure against mites in the hair. Watercress was a particularly common find across various samples. Other peptides could be linked to the cabbage and mustard family of plants, corresponding with the recommended use of brown cabbage and radish oil to treat baldness in recipes on the same page. Lipocalin was recovered next to a recipe that recommends the everyday use of human excrements to wash one's bald head for overcoming hair loss and points to the reader practitioners following such instructions. I know that's bad news. Yet, proteomics also show that historians are right when arguing against taking the written record at face value. So one sample finding, for instance, confirmed the use of cabbages and radishes to cure alopecia, as detailed in the recipes on the page. However, we also sampled peptides that confirmed the use of chicory, Easter lily, lucerne, lupines, peas, soybeans, and even eucalyptus. In one sample, we also recovered traces of Flavaria trinervia, Greater celandine, rapeseed, and spurge, whose yellow flowers would have corresponded with the early modern belief in the power of color resemblances in recipes to dye one's hair blonde, as detailed on the very same page. So proteomics reveal the existence of vibrant material experimentation in Renaissance recipe cultures. Sampled tortoise shell, soybeans, eucalyptus, ginseng, and hippopotamus bone proteins furthermore point to the global circulation of early modern medicinal materials. And obviously, historians have provided ample evidence for the global circuits of botany. However, predominantly with a focus on Italy, the Dutch, English, French, and Spanish empires, what these sampling results show is that the necessity to embrace a more global perspective in writing about materia medica in early modern Germany. The inventories of 16th century German court apothecaries, in fact, prominently mention exotica for their high monetary value. And also the business activities of this Augsburg mercantile elite positioned the city within global oceanic ties, ever denser circuits of exchange and new consumer practices. As Beverly LeMayer aptly put it, this era saw more people in contact with more things and more different things than ever before. And 16th century Augsburg was certainly a laboratory for such global material encounters. This is the city of the banker merchant families of the Fuggers and Welsers that connected Augsburg with Hungarian metals on the one hand and the Portuguese spice trade on the other hand. Fugger agents resided in Antwerp, Iberia, Venice. The Baumgartner merchant family collected news from the East Indies, and the Welser managed their colonial enterprise in early 16th century Venezuela. And prints, manuscripts, maps of new lands, new peoples, new things, alongside actual material novelties, started to fill the libraries and collections of 16th century Augsburg residents like humanist Konrad Peutinger. And plants circulated along such global routes, enriching consumer habits, material practices, and medical knowledge in Renaissance Augsburg. Humanist Ulrich von Hutten promoted the use of brazilwood as a remedy against syphilis after his cure in an Augsburg pox house, and contemporary prints point to the presence of global medicinal remedies in German apothecaries. Herbals distributed such new materials and knowledge widely across society. Already in 1496, an Augsburg herbal praises Indian nutmeg for its medicinal qualities, soaked in wine. Nutmeg, and I quote, is good for the liver and lung. If mixed with mastic, cumin, and wine, nutmeg strengthens the brain, and administered as a powder, it fortifies menstruating women. Only a few decades later, then in 1578, Lunitz's best-selling herbal recommends ginger and other kinds of exotic ingredients for the treatment of stomach problems, toothaches, cloth against the foul-smelling mouth, and pepper, incense, and sage to cure the flux inside the cheek, and so on. These were material novelties that enriched the established medical canon, created new demands, and promised financial revenues. When suggesting the daily use of non-native plants like Aster Novae Angliae to stimulate hair growth, Fugte anticipated his reader practitioners to participate in a vibrant market of globally traded materials. Rightly so, proteomics confirmed. We sampled ginseng next to recipes on how to dye one's hair blonde and red, and this plant's yellow or red-colored roots and fruits again corresponded very well with the general belief in the power of color resemblances in early modern hair care, and scientists today continue to praise the positive impact of red ginseng on hair growth. In an added recipe, a reader practitioner recommends drinking such exotic ingredients as cinnamon, cloves, and aniseed from a tobacco pipe to cure headache. The sampling of a structural peptide of either hippopotamus bone or skin next to recipes discussing various illnesses related to the head is telling, since hippopotamus bones were used to manufacture dentures. And in fact, Fugte's reader practitioners struggled with severe teeth problems. Recipes to cure stinking breath in teeth, stomatitis, mouth ulcers, and black teeth are highlighted throughout the volume. For the days of toothaches and for ulcers, an added handwritten recipe reads, put coral powder into the hole of the tooth or otherwise rub the gum with such. And to treat teeth, another addition states, make a mouthwash by mixing the water used for horses with Kreuzsalbei, a crossing of native German and Mediterranean sage species. So Fugte's reader practitioners were clearly concerned about their teeth, to sum this up, and they bothered to have personal medical experience and knowledge codified in writing, since toothache was really an occasion for family members and support networks to exchange trusted remedies. And there was good reason for Fugte's readers to worry, since toothache pointed to serious issues in their time. A 16th century prince explained the pain results from misguided hot or cold fluxes from the brain entering the teeth. Overly hot fluxes causing piercing and sharp pain, while cold fluxes materialized in swellings. Yet also evil vapors from the stomach caused severe toothache, and these hot vapors from the stomach were believed to eat up the gum, wherefore physicians prescribed strict diets. The sudden increase of humidity inside the body was considered another origin of toothache, with sweating baths, cupping therapy, and bloodletting as established cures. And toothache pointed to the development of serious health conditions and even the presence of worms inside the teeth and jaw. So early modern perceptions of toothache were anchored in broader medical notions of bodily fluxes and the impact of superfluous morbid matter accumulated in the head or in the stomach that had not yet excreted the body. Teeth pain thus required medical treatment, stimulating purgation. A particularly extreme example is what Christian Paolini calls purgation from sight. According to this 17th century treatise, the preparation of horse dung or other excrements to treat toothaches caused such repulsion that patients started vomiting, nose bleeding, and heavy sweating, whose cleansing effect would result in the cure of toothache. No need to use the excrements any longer. Moreover, early moderns warned that mouth ulcers could result directly from the workings of the devil. Such symptoms thus pointed to broader bodily and spiritual dangers and Satan's cunning attempts to take possession of bodies and souls. So medical advice pointed readers and patients towards the stars, and also the application of coral powder, as mentioned in this added recipe, points towards the use of materials with talismanic and protective qualities, since coral, for instance, was also used as teethers for babies, as you see it here. So much broader medical issues were touched by toothache. And once the pain continued, Fugte's reader practitioners were seemingly keen to expand established recipe knowledge and to experiment with non-native materials such as coral powder, salvia auriculata, agarwood, Chinese cassia, cinnamon cloves, and so on. A 1529 Augsburg print even advised the common men to take a warm ginger wine mouth wash against the pain. Also dragon blood, blood spilled by battling elephants and dragons. Yet in fact, a red-colored Indian resin was among the ingredients of remedies used against toothache. And if such ingredients did not help, 16th century physician Johann Driander recommends the use of the iron or recipes that provoke dedentation. And if the pain then still continues, he says, you know, it was not the teeth, but the nerves. So also Fugte's reader practitioners seem to have lost and replaced teeth, hence the sampled hippopotamus bone protein. Eva also recovered proteins from either tortoise shell or lizards, reptiles praised for their medicinal qualities in 16th century German treatises. So Konrad Gesner, for instance, writes that the meat of turtles, quote, shall be quite good in revitalizing, particularly useful for those who recover from illnesses. He praised the power of the turtle shell to cure dropsy, snake or scorpion venom, as well as the cataract. And such medicinal advice in 16th century Germany was built on both ancient textual authorities and new ethnographic knowledge. Gesner, for instance, states that the medical application of turtles has been described with great diligence by the old. And at the same time, he marvels the ingenious use of tortoise shell in foreign lands to make beautiful, delicious things. And also European artisans therefore started experimenting with tortoise shell when crafting ingenious artifacts. However, the sampled protein overlaps with lizards, another common ingredient of early modern medicinal recipes. Dried and pulverized lizard heads mixed with egg oil, a 16th century German recipe details, stops hair loss. Italian or French lizard oil, other recipes explain, stimulate hair growth. Quote, if you do not have this lizard oil, one recipe adds, you can prepare it in the following manner. Take living green lizards, boil them in olive oil until they decompose. Put it then into the sun for 14 or 20 days. Thus, it is good, quote ends. So the widespread debate about the use of lizards as hair care recipe ingredients in contemporary manuals point to the reader practitioner's experimentation with such knowledge, especially since the protein was sampled next to Fuchter's hair growth recipes and those against alopecia. As poikilothermic animals, lizards' own material properties were key for their assumed interaction with human hair. So according to contemporary medical theory, hair loss occurred if human's body's complexion is, quote, not powerful enough to stimulate the vapors of the brain of which hair is growing. Heat inside the body and inside the head in particular was thought to stimulate hair growth. However, too much heat could burn hair and thus result in hair loss. So many 16th century recipes thus aimed at enacting a sudden change of temperature, and the changing temperature of the physical materiality of lizards spoke to contemporary temperature-related ideas about the workings of bodily matter and materia medica. Yet, Gesner also warned that, contrary to common belief, green lizards mixed with white wine and put into the sun would rather prevent hair growth. So contemporaries were confronted with different interpretations, and the experimentation of Fuchter's reader practitioners helped advance one's own material, medical, and bodily knowledge. And this is the last point that I want to highlight as a result. Proteomics also reveal rare insights into the material interplay of Renaissance medicine and bodies. Chemists and biologists classify some of the sample or several of the sampled proteins as agents with antimicrobial properties. That is to say that they reduce the presence of microbes. So such proteins play a key role in the human immune system due to their dual ability to promote and suppress the pro-inflammatory response to microbial infection. So proteins provide unique information on the diseases that early modern reader practitioners battled with when turning to Fuchter's recipes, seeking relief from their symptoms. Dermacidine, for instance, identified in various samples, originates in human sweat glands and works as a kind of natural antibiotic against Escherichia coli bacteria and Candida albicans. While the first points to potential food poisoning and diarrhea, the latter indicates fungal yeast infection, more commonly known as thrush. This being a particularly common find across all samples detected next to recipes treating, quote, a scurfy scalp and alopecia, suggests the reader practitioner suffering from thrush on the head and hair loss. Psoriasin S100A7, as it's also called, has been identified with similar frequency. Secreted from skin cells, this protein is a body's response again to Escherichia coli, pointing again to diarrhea. And an early modern reader practitioner's handwritten comments on the efficacy of the intake of either melted cheese or vetches to cure diarrhea, as well as the repeated consumption of gunpowder to treat shigellosis, further corroborate this interpretation. Yet S100A7 also battled sepsis and meningitis, and Fuchter discusses cures for rash on the scalp and problematic wounds nearby the sampled areas. Antimicrobial proteins also showcase Renaissance body's responses to remedies. So the presence of immunoglobulin, lipocalin, and lysozyme in many samples point to an active immune response. That means Vogta's recipes stimulate the body's defense system. Sampled lysozyme, for instance, derived from tear, saliva, mucus, or breast milk, and destroys the cell walls of bacteria. And that, of course, reminds us of the wet nurse mentioned in the 17th century Marginalia. Such bodily feedback captured by advanced proteomics analysis tells a story about what recipes did to Renaissance bodies and the extent to which they changed their very physical materiality. During this time, the body was perceived as a precarious ballast of bodily fluxes, juices, their motions, interruptions, their interaction with heat and cold, humidity, nourishment, movement. And in the Renaissance mind, even the slightest change of one such elements could have severe consequences for bodily fluxes that were closely interlinked with the material environment. Since bodies were generally believed to be porous and instable, Renaissance practitioners considered remedies to penetrate the body in material terms and to adjust its imbalanced matter towards its righteous natural constitution in the ideal case. So in early modern cases, to give an example, for instance, the rush on the skin, as apparently suffered by one of Vogta's reader practitioners, would have pointed to the existence of bad humors, superfluous morbid matter that had accumulated below the skin, which had to be excreted through sweating or remedies. A rush was thus, as Michael Stolberg has argued, the mere result of the effort made by the body or the healing power of nature to get rid of this morbid matter. In light of such early modern medical notions, proteomics analysis of recipes provokes a materials-focused engagement with one of the fundamental questions of the history of the body, as posed by Rublack 2 decades ago. May it have been the case in the early modern period not only that bodily existence was conceived of differently today, but also that this body actually behaved differently? And taking on board microbiological research, neo-materialist historians like Tim LaCaine have argued that matter plays an essential role in making both humans and human history. And Julia Thomas explains, I quote, "Microbiologists jettison the idea of the human as a single species and describe us instead as a coral reef of multiple species, while biochemists examine the industrial toxins suddenly infiltrating our bodies, including our brains, raising questions about the continuity of the human in the ways we think and respond to the world," quote end. So once humans are understood to be composed of microbes, bacteria cells, proteins, and other living micromatter, it is their changing behavior and history that impacts human history. And Eva's sampling of Renaissance recipes sheds light on such material processes and captures some of the changing behaviors and productive creativity of the smallest scale material life that made up humans in the past and their experiences of the world. So this contributes to our understanding of the early modern household science as epistemic inquiries and alterations of the actual materiality of bodies on the one hand. As such, it also enriches our understanding of the curative power of past medicine and early modern stories of recovery that have become only recently the focus of research, mainly via the inspiring studies of Hannah Newton. And on the other hand, proteomics allow us to recover unique insights into the degree to which past humans differed materially from bodies today. The study of biologically active proteins thus reminds historians of the world of material vibrancy and dynamism and empowers researchers to write different histories in the age of the Anthropocene. Recipes are complex stories to work with. As Leon puts it, quote, "The challenge these sources pose prompts us historians to turn to new methods and ways of thinking about texts." And proteomics, I'd say, is such another method that invites new collaborations, interdisciplinary collaborations. It allows for the uncovering of novel and new kind of information and the interpretation of new data sets that, again, prompts a renewed engagement with questions around contextualization, interpretation, and narrative presentation of our research. So the proteomics study of early modern recipes, I argue, reveals new insights into the material travails and global trajectories of recipe cultures, the world of lay practitioners. We gain a thicker understanding of the nature of material experimentation, material flows and engagement, as well as their impact on human bodies. And furthermore, we retrieve a fuller picture of the symptoms that people struggled with when turning to recipe knowledge for help, as well as the impact of recipe trials and medical treatment on bodies, such as immune responses. Altogether, this allows for new insights into the history of medicine, material culture, bodies, and recipes. And gathering such new materials and information shifts the question that we can ask and the ways we can address them, hopefully with coming up with more new questions. And I look very much forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.